CD 14.
Evans was trembling. The blood-soaked ropes were cold on his wrists. He couldn't stand the waiting. He felt like he was going to pass out. Outside, the crowd was slowly becoming quieter. They were settling down. He knew what that meant. Soon it would be time for the next victim. Then he heard a quiet sound. It was a man coughing. Softly. Insistently. Kenner understood first. "In here!" he said loudly. There was a whacking sound as a machete blade poked through the thatched wall. Evans turned. He saw the slash in the wall widen, and a thick brown hand reached in to pull the slash wider open still. A heavily bearded face peered through the gash at them. For a moment, Evans did not recognize him. But then the man put his finger to his lips, and there was something in the gesture that was familiar. And Evans suddenly saw past the beard. George! It was George Morton, alive. Morton stepped through into the room. "Keep it down," he hissed. "You took your sweet time," Kenner said, turning so Morton could unlock his cuffs. Morton gave Kenner a pistol. Then it was Evans's turn. With a click, his hands were free. Evans tugged at the hemp ropes, trying to get them off his wrists, but they were securely tied. Morton whispered, "Where are the others?" Kenner pointed to the room next door. He took the machete from Morton. "You take Peter. I'll get the girls." With the machete, Kenner stepped out into the hallway. Morton grabbed Evans by the arm. Evans jerked his head. "Let's go."
"But..."
"Do as he says, kid." They stepped through the slash in the wall and into the jungle beyond. Kenner moved down the empty hallway. There were openings at both ends. He could be surprised at any moment. If the alarm went up, they were all dead. He saw the keys on the bench, picked them up, and went to the door of the women's room. Looking into the room, he saw that the poles were abandoned. He didn't see either of the women. Staying outside, he tossed the keys into the room.
"It's me," he whispered.
A moment later, he saw Jennifer scramble from her hiding place behind the door to grab the keys. In a few seconds, she and Sarah had both unlocked each other. They grabbed the boys' guns and started for the door. Too late. From around the corner, three heavy-set young men were coming toward Kenner. They all carried machine guns. They were talking and laughing, not paying attention. Kenner slipped into the women's room. He pressed back against the wall, gestured for the two women to go back to the poles. They made it just in time as the men entered the room. Jennifer said, "Hi, guys," with a big smile. At that moment, the men registered the two fallen boys and the blood-soaked earth, but it was too late. Kenner took one. Jennifer got the second with her knife. The third was almost out the door when Kenner hit him with the butt of the gun. There was the crack of skull. He went down hard. It was time to go. Out in the courtyard, the crowd was growing restless. Sambuca squinted. The first weight man was long dead, the body cooling at his feet, no longer as appetizing as he was before. And those in the crowd who had not tasted glory were clamoring for their peace, for the next opportunity. The women were resting their bats and pipes on their shoulders, talking in small clusters, waiting for the game to continue. Where was the next man? Sambuca barked an order, and three men ran toward the thatched building. It was a long, muddy slide down the steep hill, but Evans didn't mind. He was following Morton, who seemed to know his way around the jungle very well. They fell to the bottom, landing in a shallow running stream, the water pale brown with peat. Morton signaled for him to follow, and ran splashing down the stream bed. Morton had lost a lot of weight. His body was trim and fit,
his face tight, hard-looking. Evan said, "We thought you were dead."
"Don't talk. Just go. They'll be after us in a minute."
And even as he spoke, Evans could hear someone sliding down the hillside after them. He turned and ran down the stream, slipping over wet rocks, falling, getting up and running again. Kenner came down the hillside with the two women right behind him. They banged against gnarled roots and protruding brambles as they slid down, but it was still the fastest way to get away from the village. He could see from the streaks in the mud ahead of him that Morton had gone that way too, and he was sure that he had no more than a minute's head start before the alarm was sounded. They came crashing down through the last of the undergrowth to the stream bed. They heard gunshots from the village above, so their escape had already been discovered. The bay, Kenner knew, was off to the left. He told the others to go ahead, running in the stream bed. "What about you?" Sarah said. "I'll be with you in a minute." The women headed off, moving surprisingly quickly. Kenner eased back to the muddy track, raised his gun, and waited. It was only a few seconds before the first of the rebels came down the slope. He fired three quick bursts. The bodies caught in the gnarled branches. One tumbled all the way to the stream bed. Kenner waited. The men above would expect him to run now, so he waited. Sure enough, in a couple of minutes, he heard them starting down again. They were noisy, frightened kids. He fired again and heard screams, but he didn't think he'd hit anything. They were just screams of fear. But from now on, he was sure they would take a different route down, and it would be slower. Kenner turned and ran. Sarah and Jennifer were moving fast through the water when a bullet whined past Sarah's ear. "Hey!" she shouted. "It's us!"
"Oh, sorry," Morton said, as they caught up to him.
"Which way?" Jennifer said. Morton pointed downstream. They ran. Evans looked for his watch, but one of the kids had taken it from him. His wrist was bare, but Morton had a watch. "What time is it?" Evans asked him.
3:15.
They had less than 2 hours remaining.
"How far to the bay?"
"Maybe another hour," Morton said. "If we go cross jungle, and we must. Those boys are fearsome trackers. Many times they've almost gotten me. They know I'm here, but so far I've eluded them."
"How long have you been here?"
9 days. Seems like 9 years.
Running down a stream bed, they crouched low beneath overhanging branches. Evans's thighs burned. His knees ached. But somehow it didn't matter to him. For some reason, the pain felt like an affirmation. He didn't care about the heat or the bugs or the leeches that he knew were all over his ankles and legs. He was just glad to be alive.
"We turn here," Morton said.
He left the stream bed, dashing off to the right, scrambling over big boulders, then crashing into dense, waist-high ferns.
"Any snakes in here?"
Sarah said.
"Yeah, plenty," Morton said. "But I don't worry about them."
"What do you worry about?"
"Plenty puck-puck."
"And they are?"
"Crocodiles."
And he plunged onward, vanishing into dense foliage.
"Great,"
Evans said. Kenner stopped in the middle of the river. Something was wrong. Until now, he had seen signs of previous runners in the stream. Bits of mud on rocks, wet finger marks or shoe prints, or disturbed algae. But for the last few minutes, nothing. The others had left the stream. He'd missed where. Morton would make sure of that, he thought. Morton would know a good place to leave the river where their exit wouldn't be noticed. Probably somewhere with ferns and swampy, marshy grass between boulders on riverbanks. Grass that would be spongy underfoot and would spring back at once. Kenner had missed it. He turned around and headed upstream, moving slowly. He knew that if he didn't find their tracks, he couldn't leave the river. He would be sure to get lost, and if he stayed in the river too long, the kids would find him, and they'd kill him.
Resolution, Thursday, October 14th, 4:02 p.m. There was 1 hour left now. Morton crouched among the mangroves and rocks near the center of Resolution Bay. The others were clustered around him. The water lapped softly against the sand, a few feet away.
"This is what I know," he said, speaking low. "The submarine tender is hidden under a camouflage tarp at the east end of the bay. You can't see it from here. They have been sending the submarine down every day for a week. The sub has limited battery power, so it can stay at depth for only an hour at a time, and it seems pretty clear they are placing a kind of cone-shaped explosive that depends on accurately timed detonation."
"They had them in Antarctica," Sarah said.
"All right, then you know. Here they're intended to trigger a water avalanche. Judging how long the sub stays down, I figure they are placing them at about the 90-meter level, which happens to be the most efficient level for tsunami-causing avalanches."
"What about the tents up here?"
Evan said. "It seems they're taking no chances. Either they don't have enough cone explosives, or they don't trust them to do the job, because they have placed something called hypersonic cavitation generators in the tents. They're big pieces of equipment about the size of a small truck. Diesel-powered. Make a lot of noise when they fire them up to test them, which they've been doing for days. They moved the tents several times, just a foot or two each time, so I assume there's some critical issue about placement. Maybe they're focusing the beams, or whatever it is those things generate. I'm not entirely clear about what they do, but apparently they're important for creating the landslide."
Sarah said, "And what do we do?"
"There's no way we can stop them," Morton said. "We are only 4, 5 if Kenner makes it, which he doesn't seem to be doing. There are 13 of them, 7 on the ship, 6 on shore, all armed with automatic weapons."
"But we have Sanyang," Evan said. "Don't forget him."
"That Nepali guy? I'm sure the rebels got him. There were gunshots about an hour ago along the ridge where they first found you. I was a few yards below, just before they picked you up. I tried to signal you by coughing, but..."
He shrugged, turned back to the beach. "Anyway, assuming the 3 cavitation generators are meant to work together to create some effect on the underwater slope, I figure our best chance is to take one of the generators out, or maybe 2 of them. That would disrupt their plan, or at least weaken the effect."
Jennifer said, "Can we cut the power supply?"
Morton shook his head. "They're self-powered. Diesel attached to the main units."
"Battery ignition?"
"No. Solar panels. They're autonomous."
"Then we have to take out the guys running the units."
"Yes. And they've been alerted to our presence. As you can see, there's one standing outside each tent, guarding it. And they've got a sentry somewhere up on that ridge."
He pointed to the western slope.
"We can't see where he is, but I assume he is watching the whole bay."
"So, big deal. Let him watch," Jennifer said. "I say we just take out all these guys in the tents and trash the machines. We've got enough weapons here to do the job."
She paused. She had removed the magazine from her rifle. It was empty.
"Better check your loads."
There was a moment of fumbling. They were all shaking their heads. Evans had 4 rounds. Sarah had 2. Morton's rifle had none.
"Those guys had practically no ammo."
"And we don't either."
Jennifer took a long breath.
"This is going to be a little tougher without weapons."
She edged forward and looked out on the beach, squinting in the bright light.
"There's 10 yards between the jungle and those tents. Open beach. No cover. If we charge the tents, we'll never make it."
"What about a distraction?"
"I don't know what it could be. There's only 1 guy outside each tent and 1 guy inside. They both armed?"
Morton nodded.
"Automatic weapons."
"Not good," she said. "Not good at all."
Kenner splashed down the river, looking hard left and right. He had not gone more than 100 yards when he saw the faint imprint of a wet hand on a boulder. The damp print had almost dried. He looked more closely. He saw the grass at the edge of the stream had been trampled. This is where they had left the stream. He set out, heading toward the bay. Morton obviously knew his way around. This was another stream bed, but much smaller. Kenner noticed with some unease that it sloped downward fairly steeply. That was a bad sign. But it was a passable route through the jungle. Somewhere up ahead, he heard the barking of a dog. It sounded like the dog was hoarse, or sick, or something. Kenner hurried ahead, ducking beneath the branches. He had to get to the others before it was too late. Morton heard the barking and frowned. "What's the matter?" Jennifer said. "The rebels chasing us with dogs?"
"No, that's not a dog."
"It didn't really sound like a dog."
"It's not. They've learned a trick in this part of the world. They bark like a dog, and then when the dog comes out, they eat them."
"Who does?"
"Crocs. That's a crocodile you hear, somewhere behind us."
Out on the beach, they heard the sudden rumbling of automatic engines. Peering forward through the mangroves, they saw 3 jeeps coming from the east side of the bay, rumbling across the sand toward them.
"What's this?" Evans said.
"They've been practicing this," Morton said, "all week. Watch. One stops at each tent, see? Tent 1, tent 2, tent 3. They all stop. They all keep the motors running, all pointed west."
"What's west?"
"There's a dirt track. Goes up the hill about 100 yards and then dead ends."
"Something used to be up there?"
"No. They cut the road themselves. First thing they did when they got here."
Morton looked toward the eastern curve of the bay.
"Usually by this time the ship is pulled out and moved into deep water, but it's not doing it yet."
"Uh-oh,"
Evan said. "What is it?"
"I think we've forgotten something."
"What's that?"
"We've been worried about this tsunami wave heading toward the California coast, but a landslide would suck water downward, right? And then it would rise back up again. But that's kind of like dropping this pebble into this ditch." He dropped a pebble into a muddy puddle at their feet. "And the wave the pebble generates, it's circular.
It goes in all directions."
"Oh, no,"
Sarah said. "Oh, yes, all directions, including back to this coast. The tsunami will hit here, too, and fast. How far offshore is the Solomon Trench?"
Morton shrugged. "I don't know, maybe 2 miles? I really don't know, Peter."
"If these waves travel 500 miles an hour, Evan said, "then that means it gets to this coast in
24 seconds, Sarah said.
"Right. That's how much time we have to get out of here once the undersea landslide begins. 24 seconds. With a sudden chugging rumble, they heard the first diesel generator come to life. Then the second, then the third. All 3 were running. Morton glanced at his watch.
"This is it," he said. "They've started."
And now they heard an electronic whine, faint at first, but rapidly building to a deep electronic hum. It filled the air.
"Those are the cavitators," Morton said, "kicking in."
Jennifer slung her rifle over her shoulder.
"Let's get ready."
Sanyoung slid silently from the branches of the overhanging tree onto the deck of the AV Scorpion. The 40-foot ship must have a very shallow draft because it was pulled up close to the peninsula on the eastern side so that the huge jungle trees overhung it. The ship couldn't really be seen from the beach. Sanyoung had only realized that it was there when he heard the crackle of radios coming from the jungle. He crouched in the stern, hiding behind the winch that raised the submarine, listening.
He heard voices from all sides, it seemed like. He guessed that there were 6 or 7 men on board, but what he wanted was to find the timing detonators. He guessed that they were in the pilot house, but he couldn't be sure. And between his hiding place and the pilot house was a long expanse of open deck. He looked at the mini-sub hanging above him. It was bright blue, about 7 feet long, with a bubble canopy now raised. The sub was raised and lowered into the water by the winch. And the winch? He looked for the control panel. He knew it had to be nearby because the operator would have to be able to see the submarine as it was lowered. Finally, he saw it, a closed metal box on the other side of the ship. He crept over, opened the box, and looked at the buttons. There were 6, marked with arrows in all directions, like a big keypad. He pressed the down arrow. With a rumble, the winch began to lower the submarine into the water. The alarm began to sound. He heard running feet. He ducked back into a doorway and waited. From the beach, they faintly heard the sound of an alarm over the rumble of the generators and the cavitation hum. Evans looked around. Where's it coming from? It must be from the ship over there. Out on the beach, the men heard it too. They were standing in pairs by the entrance to the tents, pointing, wondering what to do. And then, from the jungle behind them, a sudden burst of machine gun fire opened up. The men on the beach were alarmed now, swinging their guns, looking this way and that. "Screw it!" Jennifer said, taking Evans's rifle. "This is it! It won't get any better!" And firing, she ran out onto the beach. The crocodile had charged Kenner with frightening speed. He had little more than a glimpse of huge white jaws open wide and thrashing water before he fired with his machine gun. The jaw smashed down, just missing his leg. The animal writhed, twisted, and attacked again, jaws closing on a low-hanging branch. The bullets hadn't done anything. Kenner turned and ran, sprinting down the stream bed. The croc roared behind him. Jennifer was running across the sand, heading for the nearest tent. She went about 10 yards before 2 bullets struck her left leg and knocked her down. She fell onto hot sand, still firing as she fell. She saw the guard at the entrance to the tent drop. She knew he was dead. Evans came up behind her and started to crouch down. She shouted, "Keep going! Go!" Evans ran forward toward the tent. On the ship, the men halted the descent of the submarine, stopping the winch. Now they could hear the gunshots coming from the beach. They had all rushed to the starboard side of the ship, and now they were looking over the railing, trying to see what was going on. Sanyong went down the deck on the port side. No one was there. He came to the cabin. There was a big board there, dense with electronics. A man in shorts and a t-shirt was crouched over it, making adjustments. At the top of the board were 3 rows of lights, marked with numerals. The timing board for the undersea detonations. Sarah and Morton were sprinting along the edge of the beach, staying close to the jungle as they headed for the second tent. The man outside the tent saw them almost at once and was firing bursts of machine gun fire at them. But he must have been very nervous, Sarah thought, because he wasn't hitting them. Branches and leaves snapped all around them from the bullets. And with every step, they were getting close enough for Sarah to fire back. She was carrying Morton's pistol. At 20 yards, she stopped and leaned against the nearest tree trunk. She held her arm stiffly and aimed. The first shot missed. The second one hit the man outside the tent in the right shoulder, and he dropped his gun in the sand. Morton saw it and left the forest, running across the sand toward the tent. The man was struggling to get up. Sarah shot again. And then Morton disappeared inside the tent, and she heard 2 quick gunshots and a scream of pain. She ran. Evans was inside the tent. He faced a wall of chugging machinery, a huge complex of twisting pipes and vents, ending in a flat round plate 8 feet wide, set about 2 feet above the surface of the sand. The generator was about 7 feet high. All the metal was hot to the touch. The noise was deafening. He didn't see anybody there. Holding his rifle ready, painfully aware that the magazine was empty, he swung around the first corner, then the second. And then he saw him. It was Bolden, the guy from the Antarctic. He was working at a control panel, adjusting big knobs, while he looked at a shaded LCD screen and a row of dials. He was so preoccupied, he didn't even notice Evans at first. Evans felt a burst of pure rage. If his gun had been loaded, he would have shot him. Bolden's gun was leaning against the wall of the tent. He needed both hands to adjust the controls. Evans shouted. Bolden turned. Evans gestured for him to put up his hands. Bolden charged. Morton had just stepped into the tent when the first bullet struck his ear and the second hit his shoulder. He screamed in pain and fell to his knees. The moment saved his life, because the next bullet whined past his forehead, ripping through the tent cloth. He was lying on the ground, next to the chugging machinery, when the gunman came around, holding his rifle ready. He was a 20-ish man, bearded, grim, all business. He aimed at Morton. And then he fell against the machine, blood hissing as it spattered on hot metal. Sarah was standing inside the tent, firing her pistol once, twice, three times, lowering her arm each time as the man fell. She turned to Morton.
"I forgot you were a good shot," he said.
"You okay?" she said. He nodded. "Then how do I turn this thing off?"
Evans grunted as Bolton smashed into his body. The two men stumbled back against the tent fabric, then forward again. Evans brought the butt of his gun down on Bolden's back, but it had no effect. He kept trying to hit him in the head, but only connected with his back. Bolden, for his part, seemed to be trying to drive Evans out of the tent. The two men fell to the ground. The machinery was thumping above them. And now Evans realized what Bolden was trying to do. He was trying to push Evans under the plate. Even by being near the edge, Evans could feel the air vibrating intensely. The air was much hotter here. Bolden hit Evans in the head, and his sunglasses went flying across the ground beneath the flat plate. Instantly, they shattered. Then the frames crumpled. Then they pulverized, vanished into nothing. Evans watched with horror. And little by little, Bolden was pushing him closer to the edge, closer, closer. Evans struggled. With the sudden strength of desperation, abruptly, he kicked up. Bolden's face mashed against hot metal. He howled. His cheek was smoking and black. Evans kicked again and got out from beneath him, got to his feet. Standing over Bolden, he kicked him hard in the ribs, as hard as he could. He tried to kill him. "That's for Antarctica!" Bolden grabbed Evans' leg on the next kick, and Evans went down. But he kicked once more as he fell, hitting Bolden in the head, and with the impact, Bolden rolled once and rolled under the plate. His body was half under, half out. It began to shake, to vibrate. Bolden opened his mouth to scream, but there was no sound. Evans kicked him a final time, and the body went entirely under. By the time Evans had dropped to his hands and knees to look under the plate, nothing was there. Just a haze of acrid smoke. He got to his feet and went outside. Glancing over her shoulder, Jennifer ripped her blouse with her teeth and tore a strip of cloth for a tourniquet. She didn't think an artery had been hit, but there was a lot of blood on one leg, and a lot of blood in the sand, and she was feeling a little dizzy. She had to keep watching because there was one more tent. And if the guys from that tent showed up... She spun, raising her gun as a figure emerged from the forest. It was John Kenner. She lowered the gun. He ran toward her. Sanyong fired into the glass in front of the control deck, but nothing happened. The glass didn't even shatter. Bulletproof glass, he thought in surprise. The technician inside looked up in shock. By then, Sanyong was moving toward the door. The technician reached for the control switches. Sanyong fired twice, once hitting the technician, once aiming for the control panel. But it was too late. Across the top of the panel, red lights flashed, one after another. The undersea detonations were taking place. Automatically, a loud alarm began to sound, like a submarine klaxon. The men on the other side of the ship were shouting, terror in their voices, and with good reason, Sanyong thought. The tsunami had been generated. It was only a matter of seconds now before it would hit them. Resolution Bay, Thursday, October 14th, 4:43 p.m. The air was filled with sound. Evans ran from the tent. Directly ahead, he saw Kenner lifting Jennifer in his arms. Kenner was shouting something, but Evans couldn't hear. He could vaguely see that Jennifer was soaked in blood. Evans ran for the Jeep, jumped in, and drove it over to Kenner. Kenner put Jennifer in the back. She was breathing shallowly. Directly ahead, they saw Sarah helping Morton into the other Jeep. Kenner had to shout over the noise. For a minute, Evans couldn't understand. Then he realized what Kenner was saying. Sanyong! Where is Sanyong? Evans shook his head. Morton says he's dead! Rebels! Do you know for sure? No! Kenner looked back down the beach. Drive! Sarah was in the car, trying to hold Morton upright and drive at the same time. But she had to let go of him to shift gears, and as soon as she did, he'd flop over against her shoulder. He was wheezing, breathing with difficulty. She suspected that his lung was punctured. She was distracted, trying to count in her head. She thought it was already 10 seconds since the landslide, which meant they had 15 seconds to get up the hill. Sanyong leapt from the ship to the trees on the shore. He grabbed a handful of leaves and branches. He scrambled down to the ground and began to climb the hill frantically. On the ship, the men saw him, and they jumped too, trying to follow him. Sanyong guessed that they all had half a minute before the first wave struck. It would be the smallest wave, but it would still probably be 5 meters high. The run-up, the splash on the hillside, could be another 5 minutes. That meant he had to scramble at least 30 feet up the muddy slope in the next 30 seconds. He knew he would never make it. He couldn't do it. He climbed anyway. Sarah drove up the muddy track, the Jeep slipping precariously on the incline. Beside her, Morton was not saying anything, and his skin had turned an ugly blue-gray. She yelled, "Hold on, George! Hold on! Just a little!" The Jeep fishtailed in the mud, and Sarah howled in panic. She downshifted, grinding gears, got control, and continued up. In the rear-view mirror, she saw Evans behind her. In her mind, she was counting, 18, 19, 20... From the third tent on the beach, two men with machine guns jumped into the last remaining Jeep. They drove up the hill after Evans, firing at him as they drove. Kenner was firing back. The bullet shattered Evans's windshield. Evans slowed. "Keep driving!" Kenner yelled. "Go!" Evans couldn't really see. Where the windshield wasn't shattered, it was spattered with mud. He kept moving his head, trying to see the route ahead. "Go!" Kenner yelled. The bullets were whizzing around them. Kenner was shooting at the tires of the Jeep behind him. He hit them, and the Jeep lurched over onto its side. The two men fell out into the mud. They scrambled to their feet, limping. They were only about 15 feet above the beach. Not high enough. Kenner looked back at the ocean. He saw the wave coming toward the shore. It was enormous, as wide as the eye could see. A foaming line of surf, a white arc spreading as it came toward the beach. It was not a very high wave, but it grew as it came ashore, rising up, rising higher. The jeep lurched to a halt.
"Why did you stop?" Kenner yelled.
"It's the end of the damn road!" Evan shouted. The wave was now about 15 feet high. With a roar of surf, the wave struck the beach and raced inland toward them. To Evans, it seemed as if everything was happening in slow motion. The big wave churning white, boiling over the sand, and somehow keeping its crest all the way across the beach and into the jungle, completely covering the green landscape in white as the water boiled up the slope toward them. He couldn't take his eyes off it, because it seemed never to lose its power, but just kept coming. Farther down the muddy track, the two men were scrambling away from their fallen jeep, and then they were covered in white water and gone from sight. The wave rushed up the slope another 4 or 5 feet, then suddenly slowed, receded, sweeping back. It left behind no trace of the men or their jeep. The jungle trees were ragged, many uprooted. The wave slid back into the ocean, farther and farther away, exposing the beach far out to sea. Before it finally died away, the ocean was gentle again.
"That's the first," Kenner said. "The next ones will be bigger."
Sarah was holding Morton upright, trying to keep him comfortable. His lips were a terrible blue color, and his skin was cold. But he seemed to be alert. He wasn't talking, but he was watching the water.
"Hang on, George," she said.
He nodded. He was mouthing something.
"What is it? What are you saying?"
She read his lips. A weak grin. "Wouldn't miss it if it was the last thing I did." The next wave came in. From a distance, it looked exactly like the first, but as it neared the shore, they could see that it was noticeably bigger, half again as large as the first. And the roar as it smashed into the beach was like an explosion. A vast sheet of water raced up the hill toward them, coming much higher than before. They were almost 100 feet away. The wave had come a good 60 feet up the slope.
"The next one will be bigger," Kenner said.
The sea was quiet for several minutes. Evans turned to Jennifer.
"Listen," he said. "Do you want me to..."
She wasn't there. For a moment, he thought she had fallen out of the jeep. Then he saw she had fallen on the floor, where she lay curled in pain. Her face and shoulder were soaked in blood.
"Jennifer?"
Kenner grabbed Evans's hand, pushed it back gently. He shook his head.
"Those guys in the jeep," he said. "She was okay until then."
Evans was stunned. He felt dizzy. He looked at her.
"Jennifer?"
Her eyes were closed. She was hardly breathing.
"Turn away," Kenner said. "She'll make it or she won't."
The next wave was coming in. There was nowhere they could go. They had reached the end of the track. They were surrounded by jungle. They just waited and watched the water rush up in a hissing, terrifying wall toward them. The wave had already broken. This was just surge rushing up the hillside, but it was still a wall of water 9 or 10 feet high. Sarah was sure it was going to take them all. But the wave lost energy just a few yards away, thinning and slowing, and then sliding back down to the ocean. Kenner looked at his watch.
"We have a few minutes," he said. "Let's do what we can."
"What do you mean?" Sarah said.
"I mean climb as high as we can."
"There's another wave?
At least.
bigger?
Yes! 5 minutes passed. They scrambled up the hillside another 20 yards. Kenner was carrying Jennifer's bleeding body. By now, she had lost consciousness. Evans and Sarah were helping Morton, who was moving with great difficulty. Finally, Evans picked Morton up and carried him piggyback style.
"Glad you lost some weight," Evans said.
Morton, not speaking, just patted him on the shoulder. Evans staggered up the hill. The next wave came in. When it receded, their jeeps had vanished. The spot where they had been parked was littered with the trunks of uprooted trees. They stared, very tired. They argued, was that the fourth wave or the fifth? No one could remember. They decided it must have been the fourth.
"What do we do?"
Sarah said to Kenner.
"We climb."
8 minutes later, the next wave came in. It was smaller than the one before. Evans was too tired to do anything but stare at it. Kenner was trying to stop Jennifer's bleeding, but her skin was an ugly pale gray and her lips were blue. Down at the beach, there was no sign of human activity at all. The tents were gone. The generators were gone. There was nothing but piled up debris, tree branches, pieces of wood, seaweed, foam.
"What's that?" Sarah said.
"What?"
"Someone is shouting."
They looked across to the opposite side of the bay. Someone was waving to them.
"It's San Yong," Kenner said. "Son of a bitch!"
He grinned.
"I hope he's smart enough to stay where he is. It'll take him a couple of hours to get across the debris. Let's go see if our helicopter is still there, or if the wave took it. Then we'll go pick him up."
Pacific Basin, Friday, October 15th, 5:04 p.m. 8,000 miles to the east, it was the middle of the night in Golden, Colorado, when the computers of the National Earthquake Information Center registered an atypical seismic disturbance originating from the Pacific Basin, just north of the Solomon Islands, and measuring 6.3 Richter. That was a strong quake, but not unusually strong. The peculiar characteristics of the disturbance led the computer to categorize it as an anomalous event, a fairly common designation for seismic events in that part of the world, where three tectonic plates met in strange overlapping patterns. The NEIC computers assessed the earthquake as lacking the relatively slow movement associated with tsunamis, and thus did not classify it as a tsunami-generating event. However, in the South Pacific, this designation was being re-examined following the devastating New Guinea earthquake of 1998, the single most destructive tsunami of the century, which also did not have the classic slow tsunami profile. Thus, as a precaution, the computers flagged the earthquake to the sensors of the MORN, the Mid-Ocean Relay Network, operating out of Hilo, Hawaii. 6 hours later, Mid-Ocean buoys detected a 9-inch rise in the ocean level, consistent with a tsunami wave train. Because of the great depth of the mid-ocean, tsunamis often raise the sea level only a few inches. On this particular evening, ships in the area felt nothing at all as the big wave front passed beneath them. Nevertheless, the buoys felt it and triggered an alarm. It was the middle of the night in Hawaii when the computers pinged and the screens came up. The network manager, Joe O'Heary, had been dozing. He got up, poured himself a cup of coffee, and inspected the data. It was clearly a tsunami profile, though one that appeared to be losing force in its ocean passage. Hawaii was, of course, in its path, but this wave would strike the south shore of the islands, a relative rarity. O'Heary made a quick wave force calculation, was unimpressed with the results, and so sent a routine notification to civil defense units on all the inhabited islands. It began, "This is an information message," and finished with the usual boilerplate about the alert being based on preliminary information. O'Heary knew that nobody would pay much attention to it.
O'Heary also notified the West Coast and Alaska warning centers, because the wave train was due to strike the coast in early mid-morning of the following day. 5 hours later, the Dart boys off the coast of California and Alaska detected the passage of a tsunami train, now further weakened. Computers calculated the velocity and wave force and recommended no action. This meant that the message went out to the local stations as a tsunami information bulletin, not an alert. Based on location and magnitude, the earthquake was not sufficient to generate a tsunami damaging to California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, or Alaska. Some areas may experience small sea level changes. Kenner, who was monitoring the messages on his computer, shook his head when he saw this.
Nick Drake is not going to be a happy man today.
It was Kenner's hypothesis that they had needed the cavitation generators to extend the effect of the underwater detonations and to create the relatively long-lasting landslide that would have produced a truly powerful ocean-crossing tsunami. That had been thwarted. 90 minutes later, the much weakened tsunami train struck the beaches of California. It consisted of a set of 5 waves, averaging 6 feet in height, that excited surfers briefly, but passed unnoticed by everyone else. Belatedly, Kenner was notified that the FBI had been attempting to reach him for the past 12 hours. It turned out that V. Allen Willey had vacated his beach house at 2 a.m. local time. This was less than an hour after the events in Resolution Bay had taken place, and more than 10 hours prior to the tsunami notification. Kenner suspected that Willey had gotten cold feet and had been unwilling to wait. But it was an important and telling mistake. Kenner called the agent and started proceedings to subpoena Willie's phone records. None of them was allowed to leave the island for the next 3 days. There were formalities, forms, interrogations. There were problems with emergency care for Morton's collapsed lung and Jennifer's massive blood loss. Morton wanted to be taken to Sydney for surgery, but he was not allowed to leave because he had been reported as a missing person in America. Although he complained bitterly about witch doctors, a very good surgeon trained in Melbourne took care of his lung in Gareda town. But Jennifer had not been able to wait for that surgeon. She had needed 3 transfusions during 5 hours of surgery to remove the bullets in her upper body, and then she was on a respirator, near death for the next 48 hours. But at the end of the second day, she opened her eyes, pulled off her oxygen mask, and said to Evans, sitting at her bedside,
"Stop looking so gloomy. I'm here, for God's sake."
Her voice was weak, but she was smiling. Then there were problems about their contact with the rebels. There were problems about the fact that one of their party had disappeared, the famous actor Ted Bradley. They all told the story of what had happened to Bradley, but there was no way to corroborate it, so the police made them tell it again. And suddenly, abruptly, unaccountably, they were allowed to leave. Their papers were in order. Their passports were returned. There was no difficulty. They could leave whenever they wanted. Evans slept most of the way to Honolulu. After the plane refueled and took off again, he sat up and talked to Morton and the others. Morton was explaining what had happened on the night of his car crash.
"There was obviously a problem with Nick and what he was doing with his money. Nerf was not doing good things. Nick was very angry, dangerously angry. He threatened me, and I took him at his word. I had established the link between his organization and ELF, and he was threatened, to put it mildly. Kenner and I thought he would try to kill me. Well, he did try, with that girl at the coffee shop that morning in Beverly Hills."
"Oh, yes," Evans remembered. "But how did you stage that car crash? It was so incredibly dangerous."
"What, do you think I'm crazy?" Morton said. "I never crashed."
"What do you mean?"
"I kept right on driving that night."
But Evans fell silent, shaking his head.
I don't get it.
Yes, you do, Sarah said, because I let it slip to you by accident. Before George called me and told me to keep my mouth shut about it. It came back to him then, the conversation from days ago. He hadn't paid much attention at the time. Sarah had said, he told me to buy a new Ferrari from a guy in Monterey and have it shipped to San Francisco.
When Evans expressed surprise that George was buying another Ferrari,
I know. How many Ferraris can one man use? And this one doesn't seem up to his usual standard. From the email pictures, it looks kind of beat up. And then she said, the Ferrari he bought is a 1972 365 GTS Daytona Spider. He already has one, Peter. It's like he doesn't know.
Oh, I knew, all right, Morton said. What a waste of money. The car was a piece of crap. And then I had to fly a couple of Hollywood prop guys up to Sonoma to beat the hell out of it and make it look like a crash. And then they flatbedded it out that night, set it on the road, fired up the smoke pots.
And you drove right past a wreck that was already in place, Evans said.
Yes, Morton said, nodding. Drove right around the corner, pulled off the road, climbed up the hill and watched you guys.
You son of a bitch.
I'm sorry, Morton said, but we needed real emotion to distract the police from the problems.
What problems?
Ice-cold engine block, for one, Kenner said. That engine hadn't run for days. One of the cops noticed it was cold while the car was being put on the track. He came back and asked you the time of the accident, all of that. I was concerned they would figure it out.
But they didn't, Morton said.
No. They knew something was wrong, but I don't think they ever guessed identical Ferraris.
No one in his right mind, Morton said, would intentionally destroy a 1972 365 GTS, even a crappy one.
Morton was smiling, but Evans was angry. Somebody could have told me.
No, Kenner said. We needed you to work Drake, like the cell phone.
What about it?
The cell phone was a very low-quality bug. We needed Drake to suspect that you were part of the investigation. We needed him pressured.
Well, it worked. That's why I got poisoned in my apartment, isn't it? Evans said. You guys were willing to take a lot of risks with my life.
It turned out all right, Kenner said.
You did this car crash to pressure Drake?
And to get me free, Morton said. I needed to go down to the Solomons and find out what they were doing. I knew Nick would save the best for last. Although if they had been able to modify that hurricane, that was the third stunt they planned, so that it hit Miami, that would have been spectacular.
Fuck you, George, Evans said.
I'm sorry it had to be this way, Kenner said.
And fuck you, too!
Then Evans got up and went to the front of the plane. Sarah was sitting alone. He was so angry he refused to speak to her. He spent the next hour staring out the window. Finally, she began talking quietly to him. And at the end of half an hour, they embraced. Evans slept for a while, restless, his body sore. He couldn't find a comfortable position to rest. Intermittently, he would wake up groggy. One time, he thought he heard Kenner talking to Sarah.
Let's remember where we live, Kenner was saying. We live on the third planet from a medium-sized sun. Our planet is 5 billion years old, and it has been changing constantly all during that time. The Earth is now on its third atmosphere. The first atmosphere was helium and hydrogen. It dissipated early on because the planet was so hot. Then, as the planet cooled, volcanic eruptions produced a second atmosphere of steam and carbon dioxide. Later, the water vapor condensed, forming the oceans that cover most of the planet. Then, around 3 billion years ago, some bacteria evolved to consume carbon dioxide and excrete a highly toxic gas, oxygen. Other bacteria released nitrogen. the atmospheric concentration of these gases slowly increased. Organisms that could not adapt died out. Meanwhile, the planet's land masses, floating on huge tectonic plates, eventually came together in a configuration that interfered with the circulation of ocean currents. It began to get cold for the first time. The first ice appeared 2 billion years ago. And for the last 700,000 years, our planet has been in a geological ice age, characterized by advancing and retreating glacial ice. No one is entirely sure why, but ice now covers the planet every 100,000 years, with smaller advances every 20,000 or so. The last advance was 20,000 years ago, so we're due for the next one. And even today, after 5 billion years, our planet remains amazingly active. We have 500 volcanoes, an eruption every 2 weeks. Earthquakes are continuous, 1.5 million a year, a moderate Richter 5 quake every 6 hours, a big earthquake every 10 days. Tsunamis race across the Pacific Ocean every 3 months. Our atmosphere is as violent as the land beneath it. At any moment, there are 1,500 electrical storms across the planet. 11 lightning bolts strike the ground each second. A tornado tears across the surface every 6 hours. And every 4 days, a giant cyclonic storm, hundreds of miles in diameter, spins over the ocean and wreaks havoc on the land. The nasty little apes that call themselves human beings can do nothing except run and hide. For these same apes to imagine they can stabilize this atmosphere is arrogant beyond belief. They can't control the climate. The reality is, they run from the storms.
What do we do now?
I'll tell you what we do, Morton said. You work for me. I'm starting a new environmental organization. I have to think of a name. I don't want one of those pretentious names with the words world and resource and defense and wildlife and fund and preservation and wilderness in them. You can string those words together in any combination. World Wildlife Preservation Fund, Wilderness Resource Defense Fund, Fund for the Defense of World Resources. Anyway, those fake names are all taken. I need something plain and new, something honest. I was thinking of Study the Problem and Fix It, except the acronym doesn't work. But maybe that's a plus. We will have scientists and field researchers and economists and engineers and one lawyer. What would this organization do? There is so much to do. For example, nobody knows how to manage wilderness. We would set aside a wide variety of wilderness tracts and run them under different management strategies. Then we'd ask outside teams to assess how we are doing and modify the strategies. And then do it again. A true iterative process, externally assessed. Nobody's ever done that. And in the end, we'll have a body of knowledge about how to manage different terrains. Not preserve them. You can't preserve them. They're going to change all the time, no matter what. But you could manage them, if you knew how to do it, which nobody does. That's one big area, management of complex environmental systems. Okay? Then we do developing world problems. The biggest cause of environmental destruction is poverty. Starving people can't worry about pollution, they worry about food. 500 million people are starving in the world right now. More than 500 million without clean water. We need to design delivery systems that really work, test them, have them verified by outsiders, and once we know they work, replicate them.
It sounds difficult.
It's difficult if you are a government agency or an ideologue. But if you just want to study the problem and fix it, you can. And this would be entirely private. Private funding, private land, no bureaucrats. Administration is 5% of staff and resources. Everybody is out working. We'd run environmental research as a business and cut the crap.
Why hasn't somebody done it?
Are you kidding? because it's radical. Face the facts. All these environmental organizations are 30, 40, 50 years old. They have big buildings, big obligations, big staffs. They may trade on their youthful dreams, but the truth is, they're now part of the establishment. And the establishment works to preserve the status quo. It just does.
Okay. What else?
Technology assessment. Third world countries can leapfrog. They skip telephone lines and go right to cellular. But nobody is doing decent technology assessment in terms of what works and how to balance the inevitable drawbacks. Wind power's great, unless you're a bird. Those things are giant bird guillotines. Maybe we should build them anyway. But people don't know how to think about this stuff. They just posture and pontificate. Nobody tests. Nobody does field research. Nobody dares to solve the problems, because the solution might contradict your philosophy. And for most people, clinging to beliefs is more important than succeeding in the world.
Really?
Trust me. When you're my age, you'll know it's true. Next, how about recreational land use? Multipurpose land use. It's a rat's nest. Nobody has figured out how to do it. And it's so hot, so fierce, that good people just give up and quit, or vanish in a blizzard of lawsuits. But that doesn't help. The answer probably lies in a range of solutions. It may be necessary to designate certain areas for one or another use. But everybody lives on the same planet. Some people like opera. Some people like Vegas. And there's a lot of people that like Vegas.
Anything else?
Yes. We need a new mechanism to fund research. Right now, scientists are in exactly the same position as Renaissance painters, commissioned to make the portrait the patron wants done. And if they are smart, they'll make sure their work subtly flatters the patron. Not overtly, subtly. That is not a good system for research into those areas of science that affects policy. Even worse, the system works against problem solving, because if you solve a problem, your funding ends. All that's got to change.
How?
I have some ideas. Make scientists blind to their funding. Make assessment of research blind. We can have major policy-oriented research carried out by multiple teams doing the same work. Why not, if it's really important? We'll push to change how journals report research, publish the article and the peer reviews in the same issue. That'll clean up everybody's act real fast. Get the journals out of politics. Their editors openly take sides on certain issues. Bad dogs.
Evans said, "Anything else?"
New labels. If you read some authors who say, "We find that anthropogenic greenhouse gases and sulfates have had a detectable influence on sea level pressure," it sounds like they went into the world and measured something. Actually, they just ran a simulation. They talk as if simulations were real-world data. They're not. That's a problem that has to be fixed. I favor a stamp. Warning, computer simulation may be erroneous and unverifiable, like on cigarettes. Put the same stamp on newspaper articles and in the corner of newscasts. Warning, speculation may be fact-free. Can you see that peppered all over the front pages?
Anything else? Evans was smiling now.
There are a few more things, Morton said, but those are the major points. It's going to be very difficult. It's going to be uphill all the way. We'll be opposed, sabotaged, denigrated. We'll be called terrible names. The establishment will not like it. Newspapers will sneer. But eventually, money will start to flow to us because we'll show results. And then everybody will shut up. And then we will get lionized, which is the most dangerous time of all. And? Well, by then, I'm long dead. You and Sarah will have run the organization for 20 years, and your final job will be to disband it. before it becomes another tired old environmental organization, spouting outmoded wisdom, wasting resources, and doing more harm than good.
I see, Evans said. And when it's disbanded?
You'll find a bright young person and try to excite him or her to do what really needs to be done in the next generation.
Evans looked at Sarah. She shrugged. Unless you have a better idea, she said. Half an hour before they reached the California coast, they saw the spreading brown haze hanging over the ocean. It grew thicker and darker as they approached land. Soon they saw the lights of the city, stretching away for miles. It was blurred by the atmosphere above.
It looks a bit like hell, doesn't it? Sarah said. Hard to think we're going to land in that.
We have a lot of work to do, Morton said.
The plane descended smoothly toward Los Angeles. That is the end of State of Fear. It was written by Michael Crichton and read by John Chancer. This has been an ISIS audiobooks presentation. Other titles from ISIS by this author include Timeline and Airframe. For further details of our extensive catalog of audiobooks on cassette and CD, please call our free phone number 0800-731-5637.